Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. After working at Duke University, a top cancer researcher comes home to West Virginia.
Maybe it was, you know, growing up and looking out the window and always seeing a mountain. Or the way the sun sets, the way the sun comes up, the way, you know, the shadows are. It's just something that gets instilled in your mind. I never felt like I was home until I came back.
Branded as communist troublemakers after helping an African-American family, we'll remember the Braden family from Kentucky.
It would have been unthinkable to us to say no, because this is something we believe in. Either you live by what you believe in or you don't, that's all.
And how the heck did Big Ugly West Virginia get its name? We'll explore on this week's What's in a Name segment. These stories and more in the next hour. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. It's a new era for the Coalfields. That's what media outlets across the country are saying in light of the recent indictment of Don Blankenship. You see, never before has a CEO of a mining company faced these kind of charges. Just a quick recap. Blankenship is the former leader of Massey Energy, which was once one of the largest coal producers in the country. Blankenship's charged with conspiracy to violate mine safety laws. In 2010, 29 men died after an explosion ripped through the Upper Big Branch mine in southern West Virginia, then owned by Massey Energy. The U.S. Attorney's Office of West Virginia Southern District has been moving up Massey's corporate ladder since the investigation began more than a year ago. Former Upper Big Branch Superintendent Gary May cooperated with prosecutors and admitted in March 2012 to defrauding the government by bridging methane monitors and falsifying documents. Last year, former president of once Massey-owned White Buck Coal Company, David Hugert, admitted to working with others to ensure that his mine and others owned by Massey would have advanced warnings of federal inspectors. The indictment says Blankenship requested production details at Upper Big Branch almost hourly and personally went over safety violation reports that showed the mine was almost constantly violating safety laws. William Taylor, Blankenship's attorney, said in a statement that Blankenship's outspoken criticism of powerful bureaucrats has earned him this indictment. Taylor went on to say Blankenship will not yield to their effort to silence him. After the explosion, several family members of the 29 victims gave voice for their loved ones, telling stories of intimidation, stating that several of the men didn't say anything about poor safety for fear of retaliation. Shortly after the indictment, federal judge Irene Berger silenced the families, along with other parties involved. Berger issued the broad gag order silencing all parties involved and keeping many court documents out of public eye. Now, several media outlets, including Friends of West Virginia Public Broadcasting and NPR, are challenging the order in court, saying it violates First Amendment rights. In wake of Blankenship's indictment, here's a look back to 1984, when a strike by the United Mine Workers of America against Massey first put Blankenship's name in the national news and helped fuel his rise up the chain of company command. WMMT's Parker Hobson sent us a story about that strike.
Just over 30 years ago, on October 1st, 1984, the United Mine Workers of America began a strike against what was then known as the A.T. Massey Coal Company. In hopes of maximizing profits and weakening the UMWA, Massey had held out and refused to sign the union's latest national contract, one that the union felt guaranteed better safety and health standards for miners. So the UMWA went on strike at select Massey operations, including at the Sprouse Creek Processing Plant in Mingo County, West Virginia. In 1986, Apple Shop created a film about this strike called Mine War on Blackberry Creek, and all of the audio you'll hear in this piece comes from this film. You'll hear the voice of director Ann Lewis asking questions, as well as the voices of local residents, strikebreakers hired by Massey, and many striking miners themselves.
Y'all work here?
We used to. Now we picket here for the last 8 months. Our forefathers shedded their blood for this. There ain't no way we're going to let our old pensioners down. They depend on us.
The Sprouse Creek plant was operated by a subsidiary of Massey called Rawls Sales and Processing. The president of Rawls was a young accountant who had only been with Massey for about 2 years. His name was Don Blankenship. Blankenship and Massey had brought in non-union workers, referred to by the striking miners as scabs, to keep operations running at Sprouse Creek. Some of these strikebreakers were actually former police officers, which was a part of Blankenship's larger plan to fortify the property, a plan that included barbed wire fences, armed guards, attack dogs, and surveillance cameras that filmed picketers and nearby residents.
They scabs here from Oklahoma. It's a pretty far-reaching effect this thing's having, you know. Their dog compound with their old killer trained dogs is just straight ahead here behind this little camper that you see down here in the corner of this compound. And they've got 2 miles of chain link fence put up.
This used to be a nice place to live. It's a nice neighborhood. It looks more so like a concentration camp now than it does a coal mine. Everything's behind fence, armed guards running up and down the road. And they, actually in my mind, they act like they're above the law.
The strike started relatively peacefully at Sprouse Creek, with hundreds regularly gathering for sit-ins and demonstrations that sometimes even included sermons. But in the militarized environment that Blankenship helped create, as the months wore on, things got tense. There were reports of stones thrown over the fence, strikebreakers' cars being attacked with baseball bats, and nails left on the road to puncture tires. Gunshots were reportedly fired into Blankenship's office. Emotions ran high on all sides.
They don't care about your families. They don't care about your babies. They don't care about your husband. They don't care about your wife. And Mr. Politician, we want them out of here on the same horse they rode in on. Hey! Hey! Scott, we want them out of here.
But despite all of the unrest, Blankenship said that Sprouse Creek was still making money during the strike, because essentially, they could pay the non-union replacement workers less and work them harder, and because they didn't have to worry about stopping work for potentially unsafe conditions.
The fact of the matter is our costs, despite that strike damage, are equal to or less what they were before the strike. Just a large number of reasons. But what you've got, when you're running the kind of volume we run at 200,000 tons a month, then when you throw into that the fact that we are able to better manage and we don't have any work stoppages in the meantime, and we don't have a problem with getting a guy that normally runs a roof boulder to do something else for us, where in the union he might say he ain't gonna do that. You know, that's more than made up for the strike damage. A lot of coal for a strike.
Since Massey was still making money, they could basically hold out for as long as they wanted. This wore away at the union's leverage, and after 15 long months, the UMWA gave in just before Christmas in 1985. It asked its members to go back to work, and those able to return were forced to work under the same conditions as the non-union strikebreakers. In the end, some 400 union miners were permanently fired, and the UMWA was defeated.
Now I ain't worth 2 pennies. My lungs is gone, I've lost an eye, I've lost a kidney. When the big money come in, they had to take me out of the mines. Now, they're a rich company. They got plenty of money. They was paying union wages, and they made big money. They just want to take all of it. They don't want poor people to have none of it. They want it all. They're greedy.
A man goes in the mine for 20 years. He comes out of that coal mine, and to walk down the street in Williamson or the shopping mall, he has to have a bottle of oxygen in a shopping cart in front of him. Somebody owes that man something. And Massey definitely doesn't want to face up to that responsibility.
What you have to accept in a capitalist society generally is that I always make the comparison, it's like a jungle, where a jungle's survival of the fittest. Unions, communities, people, everybody's going to have to learn to accept that in the United States you have a capitalist society, and that capitalism, from a business viewpoint, is survival of the most productive.
All the company cares for is, as long as you're making them a dollar, they're patting you on the back and you're the finest fella in the world. You stick your head out from under the, out and under that rock and get covered up. You know, there's another man standing in line waiting for your job. That's the way it is in these non-union outfits.
My dad was fighting them for the same thing I'm fighting for now. A decent wage, a little dignity and a living. And I see this battle going on for a lifetime. I don't think my dad wanted me to be a coal miner. And I didn't particularly want to be a coal miner. But that's where the money was at.
You wouldn't work non-union?
The first mine I ever worked in, Ann, was non-union, but I couldn't get a job anywhere else. I didn't have any experience. I was running a cutting machine, and I parked the cutter off to the side in a break, and I was sitting there drinking coffee, and there was a curtain up. The superintendent, the section boss, was on the other side of the curtain. And I heard the boss and the superintendent, they were just having a bull session. I heard him tell the superintendent, he said, you know, Dave, he said, my one ambition in life is to work some poor son of a bitch to death. I sat there for a few minutes. And I'd probably, I got to thinking, you know, that I was that guy that he had been treating that way. But that was the last day in an onion mine.
Following his success in this strike, Don Blankenship's star was on the rise. In 1992, he was promoted to CEO of Massey after just 10 years at the company. As chief executive, he aggressively expanded operations, kept costs low, made friends with local politicians and judges, and continued to fight the UMWA, whose membership declined steadily across the country as more and more companies followed Massey's lead and went non-union. But from the year 2000 to 2009, more American coal miners were killed at Massey Mines than at any other company. And in April of 2010, 29 miners were killed at once in a massive methane explosion at Massey's Upper Big Branch mine in Raleigh County, West Virginia. A federal investigation into Upper Big Branch has now sent four former Massey officials to prison for their involvement in a conspiracy to violate health and safety rules at Massey Mines and then cover up those violations. And even though he steadfastly denies any wrongdoing, on November 13th, Don Blankenship himself was indicted for his alleged role in this same conspiracy. If convicted, he faces up to 31 years in prison. For WMMT, I'm Parker Hobson.
Say hey, Mr. Massey, no, you ain't gonna run today. No, you ain't gonna run any coal here today. Well, you're trying to split our brothers up and have the things your way. We tell you now, it's not gonna work. The union is here to stay.
The audio clips you heard were from the film Mine War on Blackberry Creek by Ann Lewis. You can watch the entire documentary for free on the Apple Shop website. We posted the link on our website at wvpublic.org. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. When we come back, we'll hear a story about Jim Justice, West Virginia's richest man who owes $2 million in delinquent mine safety violations.
Traveling down that coal town road, listen to my rubber tires whine. Goodbye to Buckeye and White Sycamore, I'm leaving you behind. I've been a coal man all my life, laying down track in the hole. Got a back like an ironwood bent by the wind. Blood veins blue as the coal. Blood veins blue as the coal. Somebody said that's a strange tattoo you have on the side of your head. I said that's the blueprint left by the coal. Just a little more and I'd be dead. But I love the rumble and I love the dark.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Over the past few weeks, we've heard several reports from a special NPR investigation into the coal mining industry. The investigation revealed that some companies are operating above the law by not paying their safety fines. And basically, there are no penalties for the companies. But for the miners, the investigation found that the mines with more delinquent fines also have more safety violations. One of the companies with significant delinquent penalties is owned by West Virginia's richest man, a billionaire and philanthropist who gives away many more millions than he owes. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
Forbes says he's worth $1.6 billion. As of April, his coal mines owed $2 million in fines for safety violations, some going back 7 years, according to federal delinquency records. But Jim Justice is best known for his most prized possession, the 200-year-old 10,000-acre Greenbrier Resort in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. Even the bowling alley is elegant with darkened wood and plush green walls. The indoor pool is lined with pillars like a Roman bath, and the sprawling white antebellum hotel boasts 700 luxury rooms. But it's the 70 Jim Justice coal mines, with 1,200 workers in five states, that interests Celeste Monforton, a former federal mine safety official now at George Washington University.
This is a business person who paints himself as a responsible citizen who donates to charities, but there's a whole other side of that business.
The Justice Mines failed to pay more than 500 mine safety penalties, four times as many as anyone else. And while they didn't pay, these delinquent mines were cited again and again, more than 4,000 times, according to our analysis of federal records. 1,300 violations were so serious, federal inspectors said they would likely cause injury or illness if left uncorrected. Our findings trouble California Congressman George Miller, the ranking Democrat on the House Labor Committee.
He's personally worth a great deal of money. He's a major figure within the community, and yet he just simply chooses to ignore this. And he's certainly Exhibit A of the kind of operator that should not be allowed to continue with reckless disregard of the law.
Justice didn't respond to weeks of phone calls and emails about his delinquent fines, so we showed up one night at Greenbrier East High School in Lewisburg, West Virginia, where Justice volunteers as the basketball coach. Tall and bulky with a round face and bright white hair, Justice coached the Lady Spartans from the sidelines. We didn't want to interrupt, but he came over to tell us he wouldn't answer our questions.
One of the guys that is my chief operating officer and everything, he knows everything about what you want to talk about. And I know it, but he knows it better than I.
You're the owner. You're the boss. That's right. Why we want
he
to talk
to you.
He
has to talk to
you. We'll talk to both of you.
I can get him to be able to talk to you tomorrow, but I cannot talk to you at all. I just can't.
Why?
We eventually sat down with Tom Lusk, the chief operating officer of Justice's Southern Coal Corporation. Lusk says the company and the industry have had a tough time in the last 6 years.
An operator that's going to maintain a safe operation is faced with the dilemma of what gets paid and doesn't. And the unpaid fines and citations with Southern Coal have simply been not having the available cash to settle those.
Federal records show that Justice's delinquent coal mines produced more than 9 million tons in the years they didn't pay their fines. That's $500 million worth, according to average prices in the same areas reported by the Energy Department. Lusk says operating costs cut deep.
There's been no windfall in Appalachia today. All of the operations, I think, in Appalachia are struggling as far as profit margins compared to input cost. It's not there.
Still, the vast majority of mining companies, including those in Appalachia, do manage to pay their fines according to federal delinquency data. Justice himself has plenty of money. In 2009, he promised $150 million to buy and upgrade the Greenbrier Resort. 2 years later, he pledged $10 million to the Cleveland Clinic, plus $25 million for a National Boy Scout Reserve in West Virginia, where he was introduced to thousands of scouts last year.
I want to give a special thanks to the man in the white hat standing there. That's Jim Justice. You're sitting in the home of the Jim Justice National Boy Scout Scout Camp. Let's welcome Jim.
Then it was $5 million for Marshall University. And this year, back at the Greenbrier, Justice paid for 3 football fields and a training center for the New Orleans Saints. The team celebrated in a promotional video.
Total price tag, about $25 million. Justice says they're rolling out the red carpet for the Saints in every way possible.
It is a fabulous opportunity for West Virginia.
That's more than $200 million in philanthropy and investments, while his coal mines had unpaid safety fines reaching $2 million. Tom Lusk says his boss treats each of his businesses as independent operations.
He owns probably 80-plus companies. And one of the things he requires in those companies is that they stand on their own. They live and die by their own cash flow. And the real issue where we begin this conversation is, does it compromise safety? And I can absolutely say no.
We wanted to test that claim by visiting Justice underground coal mines with troubling safety records. Lusk refused, saying he'd been burned before by taking reporters underground. Instead, he sent us to a surface coal mine, the company's Tams Mountaintop Removal Mine in Raleigh County, West Virginia, with Safety Chief Pat Graham.
And every time we direct one of these employees to do his job, it's always safety first. If it's not safe, it's not going to end up productive.
Miners we spoke with who were told in advance we were coming had the same safety message. We stopped to watch a massive front-end loader scoop up piles of crushed coal and pour them into a dump truck. This surface mine has a relatively good safety record. And overall, the Justice mines had injury rates last year below the national average, according to NPR's analysis of federal injury data. But the numbers for the delinquent Justice mines aren't so good. Their injury rate for the last 5 years is more than twice the average rate. Jay Maddow supervises enforcement at the Mine Safety and Health Administration.
We can definitely say that the Justice operations meet the criteria that we review, and they are on our radar. They obviously would be. They made it onto yours, and believe me, they're on ours.
7 of the Justice delinquent mines have been hit with surprise blitz inspections that target mines with poor safety records. But the agency hasn't sought federal court orders for payment, according to court and agency records. Joe Main is Assistant Secretary of Labor for Mine Safety and Health.
It isn't an automatic, let's take them to court approach to life. It is looking at the different circumstances we have with the different mine operators and trying to figure out what is the best approach here.
Whatever the approach, the Mine Safety Agency hasn't been able to force the Justice Mines to pay, even though he's a billionaire. The agency also doesn't have the authority to shut down his or any other mines until fines are paid. Justice Executive Tom Lusk complains that Southern Coal had paid $500,000 years ago, but didn't get credit until recently. He says Justice will eventually pay the rest.
He is an individual that does not run from his obligations. And that's the case here. He's made it abundantly clear that there's no way we're going to not fully meet and satisfy these obligations.
And after we made it clear what we were going to report, Lusk told NPR that he was instructed to pay off the delinquent fines at the rate of $100,000 a month. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
Now it's time for What's in a Name, when we try to find out the story behind Appalachian towns with some unique names. Since we started this segment, we've received several suggestions to explore this place. So just how the heck did big, ugly West Virginia get its name? We'll have the answer after the break. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Back to help us again with What's in a Name, it's Shane Simmons, co-founder of the Appalachian Project.
Well, there's one West Virginia can appreciate, and it's called Big Ugly West Virginia, and that's up in Lincoln County. This is one of those places where you'll see multiple origins given for a name, too. Big Ugly Creek was supposedly either named after a very unattractive female settler that lived near the creek, or it was called Big Ugly just for the fact the creek itself was really crooked and not very pretty to look at. To me, I'm guessing that's one depends on who you ask. If you ask most folks, they'll probably tell you it's named after a very unattractive female that lived there. But I'm guessing if you ask her, she'd probably say, well, You know, I asked that very same question, and I was told it was because the creek is really crooked and not pretty to look at. So I always thought that'd be a great place for a beauty pageant, too, the Big Ugly Beauty Pageant. I'm not sure if you'd want to win that one or be fourth runner-up.
Yeah, not so sure I'd like to wear that crown. So that's the story for Big Ugly. Do you know another story about the town or know of another interesting Appalachian place? Send us a tweet at InAppalachia and we might explore on Inside Appalachia. Here's a term you might have heard on this show before, Afrolachian. It's one poet Crystal Good uses to describe herself, an African-American who grew up and lives in Appalachia. Good is a native of St. Albans in West Virginia's Chemical Valley. Good's newest poem, Appalachian Blackface, premiered this fall at the Summit on Race Matters in Appalachia, held in Charleston. She spoke with West Virginia Public Radio's Ashton Mara about the poem itself and the connections she sees between blackface performers of the 1800s and today's political leaders. As background, the elections in West Virginia ousted several state Democratic leaders and replaced two national Democratic seats with Republicans. Yet several of the candidates ran on similar pro-coal platforms. Warning, this poem contains language that some people may consider offensive.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you a story. It's a strange, fascinating, and awful tale. Staged in West Virginia during the 21st century, when they developed a unique craft, an art form of performance known as Appalachian Blackface. Appalachian Blackface was a spinoff of the minstrel shows of the 1800s, featuring working-class white men dressed up as plantation slaves. These white men imitated Negro music and dance forms in parodies known as old-time nigger shows, with colorful comic darkies, as they called them. The minstrel shows had by the 1840s become one of the central events in the culture of the Democratic Party.
There's many layers to this idea, but I'm looking at Appalachian blackface in context of the old minstrel shows, where white Southerners predominantly would put court grease on their faces and sort of mimic and lampoon African Americans in very offensive type skits, and I'm using that parallel as sort of the catalyst to the poem, suggesting that in Appalachia we are putting coal on our face, our politicians and other entities, to mimic in many ways the miner.
Appalachian blackface, or the 21st century Appalachian minstrel shows, were set on the stage of West Virginia politics. The actors were male and female politicians, and the women actors of these minstrel shows, were celebrated. Never before in American history had Appalachian women had lead roles in minstrel productions. These shows crossed Republican and Democratic party lines.
The idea that they both were campaigning on very similar platforms that were pro-coal, pro-coal, pro-coal. You know, there's many other things I felt that the campaigns could have presented to the masses, to the people in commercials. I mean, it was guns and it was coal and it was guns and it was coal. And to me, they were just performing in sort of this theatrical, you know, this made-up war on coal minstrel show. And we were celebrating them for being women. When male or female, you know, it's the same song and dance.
During campaign season, Appalachian blackface actors would smear coal across their faces to blacken their skin as they mimicked the miners they hoped to represent. Appalachian blackface performers, dressed in costumes of fine tailored suits, carried shotguns and pretended to be defensive soldiers in a theatrical war on coal. A fantasy created as a backdrop for their minstrel parodies that pretended to support miners and Appalachian communities.
This idea is so emotional and it evokes so much emotion that it's brilliant in terms of, you know, putting it as a backdrop, as a theater that gives you character, it gives you plot points, it gives you an enemy, and it gives you a hero. But I think there's many people out there that would agree with me in saying that there's no war on coal.
just as the minstrel performers of the 1800s created songs and skits that mocked African Americans, so did Appalachian blackface performers mock the intelligence of the region's people and the coal miners by promising them generations of jobs and health. Appalachian blackface performers romanticized the plight of the miner with expressions of admiration, pretending to support the happy-go-lucky miner on the mountain, the dandified fool, often singing a traditional tune, "It's our way of life, of life. It's our way of life, of life."
We are part of the show. We're tap dancing and singing to entertain the entitled, right? Because we're so distracted in how the world sees us. It's always, why do you live there, right? Like, why in the world would you stay in Appalachia? Why would you live there? Because there's a very distorted lens about who we are and, you know, our lifestyle. And I think that that is what hinders our growth. It's our perception. It's how people perceive us. It's the opportunity that doesn't exist here is what people think, because that's what we project, because we're so desperate. We have nothing else but coal. We have to fight for this coal. And therefore, that doesn't make us very attractive. Like, who would want to move their family to a war zone?
Appalachian blackface performers with the muse of coal held true to the intent of the 1800 minstrel shows, with their overt racial traditions of mocking the colored, the Negro, the black, the African American. They did this with a direct focus on portraying America's first black president, Barack Obama, as the ultimate fool, the ultimate enemy. He's not for us. They created parodies of the president in the hearts and minds of their audiences.
It's a delicate, delicate line in terms of how I see it and how many other people see it. But I do think that race and the president's race makes him a very easy target to steer a lot of emotions in a state that is predominantly white, that doesn't have a lot of diversity. I do think that part of the war on coal has positioned the enemy by leveraging undertones of racism.
The tradition presented a caricature of America's president as incompetent, the miners as desperate, the people of the land dependent. Sadly, Appalachian blackface did not slow down in the first 100 years of the 21st century. It left an enduring legacy that propagated Appalachian culture to international audiences through a distorted lens of exploitation for generations. Appalachian blackface cultivated a power movement that equally united and divided the region according to a new race they called coal.
To hear the full version of Good's poem, you can head to our website at wvpublic.org. Residents in Louisville, Kentucky have been having their own conversation about the history of racial tension in the area. This year, the city has been marking the touchstone event in its history. 60 years ago, a white couple, Ann and Carl Braden, purchased a home on behalf of a young black family. On Inside Appalachia, we've been hearing excerpts from a documentary that was made about the Bradens. And this week, reporter Rick Howlett of WFPL in Louisville reports on the events 60 years ago that touched off weeks of racial violence and led to serious criminal charges against the Bradens.
This neighborhood in the Louisville suburb of Shively seems a most unlikely place for cross burnings, gunfire, and a dynamite attack. But that's exactly what happened along the street over the course of several weeks in 1954. The hostility began when an African-American family, Andrew Wade, his pregnant wife Charlotte, and their two-year-old daughter Rosemary, moved into their new home at 4010 Roan Court. Andrew Wade was an electrician who wanted to move his family to the suburbs but was turned down by a succession of white realtors who refused to cross the illegal but still highly observed line of segregation. In this interview from the 1980s, featured in the documentary Ann Braden, Southern Patriot, Wade recalls a piece of advice he received from one realtor.
He said, "Wade, let's be realistic. If you see a house, you like the house, regardless of where it is, get a white person, if necessary, if it's in a white neighborhood, to buy the house for you and transfer it to you." He said, "It's that simple."
So that's what he did. Wade enlisted the help of acquaintances Carl and Ann Braden, left-wing activists who had been vocal in their opposition to Louisville's housing segregation laws. The transaction was completed, but trouble began as soon as the Wades moved in, as Ann Braden recalls in the documentary.
That night, they heard gunshots, and somebody was firing at the house. And Andrew said he told his wife to get down and so forth, but it didn't hit anybody. And they looked out, and there was a cross burning in the field next to him.
There would be more trouble in the days to come. A stone bearing a racial epithet hurled into a window. The local dairy refused to deliver milk. The Wade's newspaper subscription was canceled because the carrier wouldn't deliver it. Police were stationed nearby for protection, but the Wades and their white allies didn't trust them, so they formed a committee whose members would take turns staying in the house. One of the guards was Louis Lubka, now 88 and the last surviving activist.
And I was in the back kitchen with a gun, and when we were shot out, we shot back. And I was working days and helping guard the house nights.
Several weeks went by and tensions seemed to ease a bit, but just after midnight on June 27th, 1954,
Wade was coming in and a bomb went off under the house.
The home was blown up with dynamite. The explosives were placed under the room of 2-year-old Rosemary Wade. No one was in the house at the time. Kate Fossil is a biographer of Ann Braden and heads the Braden Institute for Social Justice Research at the University of Louisville. She says it was no secret who was responsible for this and other attacks, but
no indictments were returned against any of the neighbors, even though they had admitted to burning a cross and being hostile to the idea. But all of the indictments were against the whites who had supported the Wades in this quest for a house.
Ann and Carl Braden and the five other whites were charged with sedition, accused of hatching a communist plot to buy the home, blow it up, touch off a race war, and overthrow the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Today, it sounds outrageous. But in this interview from the collections of the Kentucky Historical Society, Ann Braden provided some context. This happened at the confluence of McCarthyism and the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education Supreme Court ruling that outlawed school segregation.
And I've always felt that the Wades and us became lightning rods. They couldn't get it at the Supreme Court, but they could get it us.
Carl Braden was convicted of sedition and spent 8 months in prison. The following year, a ruling came down from the U.S. Supreme Court in a Pennsylvania case that said, in essence, sedition is a federal crime and not a state offense. Carl Braden's state conviction was later reversed, and the charges against the other defendants were dropped. Branded as communist troublemakers, all the defendants had trouble finding work in the following years. Carl Braden died in 1975. Ann Braden continued her work opposing housing and school segregation. The Wade family attempted to repair their home, but amid continuing hostility, sold the house at a loss and moved back to the inner city where Charlotte Wade still lives. She no longer speaks publicly about the case. Andrew Wade died in 2005. Ann Braden, who died in 2006, told the Kentucky Historical Society that she had no regrets about helping the Wades buy their dream home.
It would have been unthinkable to us to say no, because this is something we believe in. Either you live by what you believe in or you don't. That's all.
Braden biographer Kate Fossil says the Bradens and the Wades would be proud of how the once troubled Shively neighborhood has changed.
It is one of the most integrated, multiracial, multicultural neighborhoods in Louisville today.
It's also the home of 31-year-old postal worker Steve Ebbs, his wife, and 2 young daughters.
It's about a rock's throw from here.
Ebbs is standing next to a historical marker erected near the Wade home site a few years ago. He's the great-nephew of Andrew and Charlotte Wade and lives down the street from 4010 Roan Court, now called Clyde Drive. Ebbs has been the family's spokesman during the anniversary commemorations.
It's something that I really take pride in, and I've made sure that my children
understand the significance of the fact that there's a monument here, and it is our blood relatives that went through what they did to receive something like that. So I make sure that I definitely give it the respect that it's due.
Rick Howlett, WFPL News.
We all know that there are lots of talented, intelligent, and just plain good people from Appalachia. Today we meet Bill Petras, a native of Wheeling, West Virginia, who ran one of the top cancer research labs in the country for more than a decade. But as Gene Snediger reports, West Virginia called him home.
This is our clinical pharmacology laboratory. One of the many things we do here is to look at the blood concentrations of anti-cancer drugs. I'm Bill Petras. I grew up in Wheeling, West Virginia, in Ohio County. And I am currently the Milan Chair of Pharmacology at West Virginia University. I'm also Associate Director for Anti-Cancer Drug Development at the Mary Babb Randolph Cancer Center at WVU.
53-year-old Bill Petras is one of the few clinical pharmacologists in the United States who does cutting-edge research into new cancer drugs. He also designs early drug trials to investigate why cancer drugs react differently from one person to the next.
Any two people that take a drug, sometimes the concentrations that one person has in their blood, even though they've gotten the same dose as the next person, vary over a 3 to 10-fold range or more. And that variability is important because it can determine why someone gets side effects versus another person doesn't, or why the drug works versus another person that doesn't.
Petras and his research team are learning why people react differently to a drug or combination of drugs and how effective the drug treatment is. The number one variable is smoking.
Tobacco smoking can affect the body's ability to react to a drug. Sometimes it can accelerate its metabolism, or it could change it in other ways. One of the projects that I have going is we're trying to evaluate how a particular anti-cancer drug is affected by smoking.
If a cancer patient continues to smoke, and some do, they may not be getting the right dose of the drug for their treatment. Besides tobacco, Petras' lab looks at how body size, age, genetics, or body chemistry can affect how much of an anti-cancer drug a patient should receive. It's all part of the new world of personalized medicine. Bill Petras believes that West Virginia, which draws its patients mostly from the community rather than far away, is uniquely placed to carry out this kind of research.
One of the things that will strike you about Bill's work is that he's always thinking a year ahead of several other people.
Laura Gibson, leukemia researcher and deputy director of the Mary Babb Randolph Cancer Center.
Bill is really talented in seeing what we have that's unique here, thinking about our populations in a way that he can weave those into cutting-edge science.
How cutting-edge is what Bill does?
One example of how he is doing very contemporary work is a statewide genomics network that he collaborates with a group from Marshall University. He leads our effort here. This is specifically focused on understanding cancer patients in West Virginia at a genetic level and how that precise information can be used to give them best care possible. That's the level of science that really moves an institution forward and moves the health care of a state forward.
For more than a decade, Bill Petras led his own research lab at Duke University Cancer Center, one of the top cancer research centers in the United States. Then, out of the blue, he got a call from West Virginia University.
I wasn't looking to move. I had multiple grants. I had multiple people working in my laboratory. And I asked myself when the call came, do I want to continue what I'm doing for the next 10 or 20 years? And sure, I can make an impact and nationally and et cetera. Or do I want to make that impact and in addition, help the people back home that really were the reason why I got into this in the beginning?
Petras felt a pull back to WVU, where he'd studied pharmacy, and where he had first become interested in pharmaceutical research. Plus, Petras and his wife Karen, also a research pharmacist and a West Virginian, wanted to raise their children here. So he waited until June 20th, then signed the WVU contract to honor his home state on its birthday.
The environment here between the scientists, the basic scientists, and the clinicians is very unique, and they love working with each other, and they love listening to each other. It's very unique, I think, and it's reflective of West Virginia.
the other side of that is a sense of belonging and a sense of being from a unique place. The stamp that West Virginia puts on you and the picture you have of the state in your mind. Maybe it was, you know, growing up and looking out the window and always seeing a mountain, or the way the sun sets, the way the sun comes up, the way, you know, the shadows are. It's just something that gets instilled in your mind. I never felt like I was home until I came back.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jean Snediger.
This piece is part of an ongoing series on West Virginia Public Radio called Inspiring West Virginians. The series tells the stories of West Virginians who are exceptional leaders in science and business. Bill Petras and three others will be featured in the newest program. We'll meet more inspiring West Virginians in some of our upcoming shows. And while Bill Petras and researchers are looking to promote a better future for Appalachians, folks in the region still hold tightly to their traditional roots and cherish the past. Gibbs Kinderman with the Traveling 219 Projects brings us the story of an old store that existed for about 100 years in Pocahontas County, West Virginia.
Country stores were the center of community life 100 years ago. They often housed the local post office and provided an informal meeting place for discussion of local affairs and the great issues of the day. These stores sold staples, groceries, hardware, clothing, shoes and boots, guns and ammunition, and bought furs and herbs such as ginseng. Country stores, for the most part, also provided goods on credit to local customers, and in many cases also delivered grocery orders to residents who could not conveniently get to the store. As the roads were paved and many families obtained cars and trucks, the role of the general store diminished. More and more people traveled to the county seat towns to do their trading. Still more recently, the advent of big box chain stores has in large part decimated the small town retail trade, and the rural general store is largely a thing of the past. One such general store stood for over 100 years at Mill Point, at the intersection of U.S. 219 and State Route 39, the road to Richwood. It was just across Stompin' Creek from the McNeil Mill in southern Pocahontas County. The store itself was on the ground floor, with ware rooms and an apartment on the second story. Nowadays, the old Mill Point store lives on only in memory, including mine, since I lived just up the hill from the store from 1986 to 2000, and my daughter Joanna still makes her home there. Built by local farmer and businessman William Billy Aldridge in 1900, when the timber boom brought new prosperity to the area, it served the community for more than 50 years under the direction of Billy and his son Reuben, Rube Aldridge. Billy was also postmaster of Mill Point, which provided extra revenue for the store. Rube inherited that position along with the store when Billy died in 1919. After almost 30 years, Rube himself passed away shortly after World War II, and his widow, Belvesta Aldridge, leased the store to Winters Hefner, father of Black Mountain Bluegrass Boys founders Bill and Richard Hefner. Winters, in turn, became the postmaster as well. His son Richard remembers vividly the sights, sounds, and smells of the store back in the 1950s.
It had a big long, had a porch all the way across the front and one all the way down the side, and you could spit off the porch and spit right in the middle of the creek because it sat right on the edge of the creek, and the other side of it was against that rock cliff over there. And he had about everything in that old store. It was a post office, and had 100-pound sacks of feed in the back of it, had loose beans, Longhorn cheese, nails, bolts, shoes. He bought furs of all kinds and roots, and had, there was a room in the top of the store in the back. You went up a set of steps inside the store, and he had a room up there where he kept all the roots and all the hides. Yeah, we had some good times in there, hiding in those feed sacks in the back, and maybe snitch a candy bar or something, go back sure. in there. Yeah, it was good times.
Winters Hefner gave up the store in 1959, and it was taken over by Alfred Dean, who ran it for a few more years. The upstairs apartment continued to be occupied for another 30-plus years, while the store space downstairs was used for various short-lived enterprises, including a bingo parlor and a junk and antique shop. The Trinity Baptist Church, now located just up US 219 near Buckeye, held its early services in the store. But the building gradually deteriorated, and in 2006, the West Virginia Division of Highways bought and demolished the store as part of a bridge replacement project. Luckily, one old general store in the area has found new life and a new purpose. The Pretty Penny Cafe in Hillsborough, 2 miles south of Mill Point on US 219, was for more than 50 years Moore's store, and the restaurant still retains an old-fashioned feel, with the shelves ranging up to the patterned tin ceiling, the old rolling ladder for reaching the top shelves still in place, and a sampling of products from days gone by. But there is a real modern-day equivalent of the old-fashioned general store in Hillsborough. McCoy's Market, a one-story structure with two aging gas pumps, offers a variety of groceries and a small but handy stock of electrical and plumbing supplies and other hardware items, plus a sandwich and pizza service. McCoy's also has a seemingly bottomless pot of coffee, where the men of the community gather before work each morning to compare notes and swap lies. You could say that James L. Laverne McCoy is the Billy Aldridge of the 21st century. For Traveling 219 and West Virginia Public Radio, this is Gibbs Kinderman.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from NPR, WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, and Traveling 219. Music in today's show was provided by Andy Agnew Jr., the Glenville State College Bluegrass Band, Andrea Tomasi, and Billy Ed Wheeler with Cold Tattoo. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or at @WVJessicaYLily. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at WVPublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.